Okay, Ezrat Hashem, good evening. So the parsha is Bechukotai, and the discourse, the maimer we're going to be looking at, was said on Shabbat, Parshat Bechukotai, which was also the 17th of Iyar, just like this year. Shabbat will be the 17th of Iyar, and Sunday will be the 18th, which is Lag Ba'omer. And I would say that there's, even though the discourse doesn't directly mention Lag Ba'omer, I would say indirectly it's all about Lag Ba'omer. So we'll explore that. We'll be exploring the discourse in a minute. First, let's have a look at the beginning of the Parsha Bechukotai. Im Bechukotai Telechu, if you walk in my statutes, Ved mitzvotai tishmuru, and you guard my mitzvot, va'asitem otam, and you do them. V'natati gishmechem bi'itam, then comes a whole list of brachot, of blessings. I'll give rain, your rain in its season. V'natna ha'aretz yuvula, and the earth will give its produce. Ve'etz ha'sadeh yiten piryo, and the trees of the field will give their fruit. And in verse 6, V'natati shalom ba'aretz, I'll give peace in the land. U'shchaftem ve'ein machadid, you will lie down without worrying. V'hishbati chaya ra'a min ha'aretz, and I will make cease all wild animals from the earth, from the land. V'cherev lo ta'avo ba'atzachem, and the sword, weapons, won't pass through your land. And then it goes on, verse 11, V'natati mishkani betochachem, I will put my dwelling among you. And in verse 12, V'hitalachdi betochachem, I will walk among you. V'ayiti lachem l'lakim, I will be to you as a God. V'atem tiyu li la'am, and you will be to me a people. Ani Hashem Elokechem, I am Hashem your God, Asher hotzeiti etchem me'eretz Mitzrayim, miyot lachem abadim, lahem abadim. I am Hashem who took you out of the land of Egypt, so that you shouldn't be slaves to them. Va'eshbor motot ulchem, I broke the thongs of your yoke. Va'olech etchem kom miyot, and I brought you upright out of there. So that is the, as he translated, I brought you with your heads held high. So that is all the positive blessing which is there in this parsha, in this Torah reading. And then it goes on, v'im lo tishmuli, what will happen if you don't obey me? And then comes a terrible description of destruction, which can be seen as a description of all the terrible things that have happened to the Jewish people over the millennia. So that's where the discourse takes off, from this very positive description, which we're going to try to explore together. It's an unedited discourse. It was said in 1984 and on that Shabbat. And it appeared this week in the Dvar Malchut, with pointing and with a little bit of commentary to help explain it. And of course the footnotes giving sources. Ayam bamba yamba yo yaram ho yara ya yo yamba. Yamba, 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 yo, yambo. Ha, yadadamba, ya, yadadamba, yo, mba, yo. Ya, yadadamba, ya, ya, yo. Ha, yadadamba, yamba, yo. Ya, yadadamba, ya, yadadamba. Ho, mba, mba, yamba, yadadamba. Ho ya yamba yadadam bom, ho ya ya ho ya yam bom. Im bechukotai telechu ved mitzvotai tishmru, if you walk in my statutes and you keep my mitzvot, va'asitem otam, and you do them, u'mava b'zeh kvod kedushat admo hazaken. Now the first Chabad Rebbe, b'lekutei Torah, in his book Likutei Torah Parshatenu on this Pasha, what the Rebbe calls in the Chassidische Pasha von der Woche, there's the idea that as well as studying the Chumash with Rashi, one should also study it in Torah or Likutei Torah, which are the books by Rabbi Shneur Zalman about the Parshat HaShavua. So it's like a very standard work in Chabad Chassidut. The Inyan B'chukatai Telechu, he explains there that walking in my statutes, B'chukotai, in my statutes. Now that word, chukah, chukah means a law, but it also relates to the word chakika, engraving. Ka'ei al bechinat ha-chakika shebatorah. The engraving, this refers to the concept of engraving in the Torah. Now, in fact, what he says there in B'chukotai, in Likutei Torah, he compares when you engrave on stone, the letters are actually part of the stone. There's nothing separate. It's not a separate entity, the words, the letters. The stone is engraved, and so there you have a block of stone, and now you've engraved the words, so the words are part of the stone. Whereas if you're writing with ink on parchment, the ink, it dries on the parchment, and so you have the words on the parchment, but the words are actually separate from the parchment. And if you decided that you wanted to erase these words, you take a knife and you scrape off the words, and you scrape enough, you can get it completely off. So the words and the parchment are two different things. Whereas if you're talking about engraving on stone, it's thoroughly part of the stone. There's no way you can take it away. You can grind the whole stone down to another level, but shave off the whole top of the stone. But in itself, these words are fully part of the stone now. Now, what does that represent? As it explains in Likutei Torah, V'ahaynu kiyum ha-mitzvot b'machshava. These are the keeping of mitzvah with thought. That's a very interesting idea. There are mitzvah where thought is involved. He doesn't spell out which mitzvot he's talking about here, and it's worth spending a moment. First of all, when a person prays to Hashem, thought is part of that process. You say, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. According to the Shulchan Aruch, the code of law, you really have to be thinking what that means at that moment. It's if the person is just saying it, blah, 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 you know, as if, you know, that they haven't fulfilled the duty of saying the Shema. The Shema, you have to have that in your mind. Ideally, you have to have in mind everything that a person prays, but there are certain points where it's crucial. And saying those words of the Shema, that's a crucial point to think of the oneness of God. And our whole tract, the second part of Tanya, is in fact a preparation what to think about while one is saying the Shema. It's in itself the whole content of that. Now that's one mitzvah of machshava. Another mitzvah of machshava, of thought, is when one is studying Torah. You study Torah, there's a mitzvah to actually read words of Torah. And when one is studying most parts of the Torah, it's very important that you should understand what you're saying and understand the whole rationale. Most Torah teachings have some, like in the Talmud or Hasidic thought, they have in Tanya, they have a complicated relationship. They're explaining something, and it's several steps to keep in mind. So that's another mitzvah of machshava, thinking through the teaching of Torah that one is studying. Other mitzvah b'machshava, I mean, there is you see there's something negative, which is what's called lashon hara, speaking badly about people. And even worse, the Chofetz Chaim wrote in the 1910, I think it was, around then, the beginning of the 20th century. He wrote a series of books. Shmirat HaLashon is the most famous. He wrote books about not speaking with the evil tongue, Lashon Hara, not speaking against other people. Now, in Tanya, it mentions this concept of not speaking against other people, and he says, of course, even worse than speaking is thinking. If one thinks bad about another person, that's it's sort of in a more intense level. It's true that in practical terms, it doesn't necessarily have the same kind of effect. One of the problems with speaking bad about people, presumably you're not speaking to yourself, you're speaking to someone else, and so you're conveying to someone else a bad reputation about this person. Incidentally, even if it's true, but to spread the bad reputation is again a negative thing. And if it's not true, of course, then it's worse. But one can severely damage another person just by speaking bad about them, and other people hear this and they accept it, and it changes their view of the person. It damages the person. But thinking, as far as one is concerned in terms of our relationship with God, and for that matter our relationship with other people, thinking bad about another person is also negative. Now, I would suggest, al achat kama v'kama, how much more to think good about other people is something positive. It's there's a verse quoted in Tanya, kamayim hapanim lapanim kein lev adam laadam, like the water of the pool looks up of the water, the face in the water, the reflection of the face in the water looks up at you according to what face you make in the water. If you frown into the water, it'll frown. If you smile, it'll smile. Kein leva adam la adam. So in other words, if in your heart you think good about another person, then they'll think good about you. Like a spiritual connection between people. By thinking good about someone, you affect them to think good, or maybe just to be happy. If you're... Sorry?
I don't think that always
works. It doesn't always work.
I do know.
You?
No, because I heard it years ago, and I often think about it. And I don't think it's 100% true.
So you find that you think good about people, and they're just as nasty.
I'm saying you can manipulate people that, you know, in that sort of way. I mean, you know, play with it and see does it work or not, like they say, but I don't think it always works.
I don't like the word manipulate. I don't think it's the right word for good thoughts.
If you're doing something in order to get an effect, that's manipulation, whether it's for good or for bad. That's still manipulation.
Well, if you're doing it for manipulation, it's not going to work, I think.
Well, let's say you have a very problematic child. So you can think bad thoughts about the child, or you can think good thoughts. So the question is, you're thinking good thoughts about the child. I suppose you're hoping that this will have a good effect on the child's self-image.
Well, something good or bad, if you think of it that you're very angry with the child for what they've done, however, you know that the child's fragile and therefore doesn't, even though you're angry, he doesn't need to feel the anger, he needs exactly the opposite. So therefore, that's what you do. Now, that's a manipulation, however, it's for the good.
Well, I didn't get it.
If you're...
The child's done something wrong.
Okay.
And you're angry.
Is the light too bright for you?
So?
Is that light too bright for you?
No, it's fine. I have problems with that. No, everything's fine. So, you think badly about him or good or well about him?
If you're angry.
Yeah.
Because of the behaviour.
Yes. Yeah.
You're angry, you're upset.
Okay.
However, you know that for the benefit of the child, you can't show your anger. Yes?
So what's a manipulation?
You show a loving face, which is a manipulation.
Well, you can't think, well, you can show a loving face, but you can't think well about anyone if it's not genuine, if you really don't feel so. Well, I have an experience in this. You see, I have a problematic child, and I have a very difficult relationship with him, one of my sons. And for years, I was very angry with him. I thought I didn't deserve it, you know. But then I got more mature. And he was 37, 36, and he was very lonely and very angry. And I just felt sorry for him. And I stopped being angry with him. And I started sending him love. Just like this. I felt the love. I felt, genuinely, I felt the love. After many years of being angry with him. And I sent him the love, and I did it for a few months. For a long time. And immediately after that, he started looking for a wife. And after 2 years, he got married. And now he has two children, thanks God, you know. And
how to get grandchildren.
I'm sure it helped. But it was manipulation. It was genuine.
You're doing it something for a purpose. You know, it's not...
Well, I think the thing about the word manipulation, it's got a pejorative concept. You know, if obviously one does things and hoping for a response, but to call it manipulation suggests a deceitful or pejorative aspect to it. You know, so what would you call it if it's? That's part of regular human relationships, is to do something, even if it's thinking something, with the hope that it will provoke a positive response. So, I think it's very beautiful that it worked in your case with your son. And I think that sometimes you might feel it doesn't work, but you can't tell, because it could be that if the person thought bad thoughts about that person, they would behave in an even worse way. You know, I suppose this is the kind of thing that you could do some sort of laboratory test, you know, with 50 subjects who have to think good about each other or something.
And from your experience, it's working, good and bad.
I only know the good, and everyone I know is very nice.
So it works if you think good things, it works?
Look, I try to... where I try to do this most, actually, is with the children that I teach. The young people, the young teenage girls that I teach in school, you know. So I try to think positively about them, and... I hope that they have a good... I try to talk to them positively as well. I don't just think about it. You know, I tell them that they are people with who are empowered, and they're going to change the world. And they have tremendous positive qualities, you know, and I hope that it all rubs off on them. It all has an effect. I believe it has an effect. Believe it, and it does have an effect. That's unfortunately, most of the people I know are very nice. So
are very
nice people. So that's machshava. So machshava, thought, doing mitzvah with thoughts, that is the engraved. That is something engraved within the person. Now, it says first, Im chukotai telechu, if you walk in my statutes, so that chukotai is the idea of engraving, chakika, and that is thought. Then there is a commentary which goes on, umashikatuv, this is line 6 of the middle, umashikatuv et mitzvotai tishmuru, and when it goes on to say, you should keep my commandments, Kai al kiyum hamitzvot bedibur. This means keeping the mitzvot with speech. Things like tefillah, Torah study, but with speech. And again, you know, there's the speech dimension of Avat Yisrael and other things as well. Va'achakach v'asitem otam, and then it says, v'asitem otam, you should do them. Hainu kiyum hamitzvot b'maseh. That means keeping the mitzvot in practical action. וחשיב כאן עד כי אם המצוות בכל שלושת הלבושים דמחשבה דיבור מעשה. And it's considering here, it's describing here, keeping mitzvot in, with all these three garments of thought, speech, and action. Now, the garments are the garments of the soul. This is an interesting perspective of Chabad Hasidic thought, that what we call action, speech, or thought, which, you know, we might consider that's, you know, what we're doing. We're doing such and such. We're saying it. We're thinking it. This is regarded as the garment of the soul. So the soul is the deeper dimension, and then the soul expresses itself through various garments. So one of the garments is thought, that's the innermost garment, and then speech, and then action. Now this service of thought, speech, and action in general, ובפרט כפירוש התורת כהנים, and especially according to the Midrash Sifra, which is the Midrash, which is called in Hebrew Torat Kohanim, Kohanim, quoted in Rashi on the Pasuk, דאם בחוקותי תלכו, what does it mean, you should walk in my statutes, שתהיו עמלים בתורה, you should make an effort in Torah, in Torah study and generally, bevchinat amal, in a way of effort. Now this concept of effort is very interesting, because we're often challenged what we would like to think and what we should think, what we would like to say, what we should say, what we would like to do and what we should do. And the effort is a crucial thing. Now, someone wrote a book about Chabad, and Foxbrunner is his name, Raymond Foxbrunner. And in the introduction to the book, he contrasts the serene atmosphere of Greek, the Greek philosophical ideal, kind of ideal of serenity. He contrasts that, I think he calls it the Faustian European struggle concept, that there's a struggle going on. You know, Dr. Faustus, you know, person in the middle of a terrible struggle. And he said, if you were trying to position Chabad Hasidic thought in this, between those two poles, he says you'd put it rather at the Faustian side, the struggle. Because, although there is serenity, and there are concepts of serenity, and one utilizes the idea of serenity and the acquisition of serenity, but nonetheless, Adam la'amal yulod, man is born to struggle, and there are different kinds of struggle that we have to achieve or go through. Maybe never complete, that there is always the struggle going on. And the very concept of the Beinoni, the intermediate person, which is the subject of Tanya, is a person who might be beset by the most terrible thoughts and temptations, which somehow he or she manages to withstand. I mean, there are different techniques, you know, what this struggle looks like. I've always believed, looking at Reb Mendel Futterfuss, whose picture is on the wall over here, that he achieved this struggle through humor. Good humor. Being able to make fun of oneself. But the ability to make fun of oneself is a way that one can balance very heavy forces, which might be pulling in the wrong direction. But the fact that you're able to make fun of yourself, that's the way of somehow sidestepping or enabling these forces to balance each other, and you sort of get through. I think of the Beinoni as someone who's walking apparently serenely along a very narrow path, like the Braslav song, you know, the whole world is a very narrow bridge. That's and that sense of this narrow bridge. And the effort, so it might look effortless at any particular moment, but I think there is great effort there. Now this amal, which he's describing here, this effort, is the key concept in this discourse. It comes up at the end as well. So you've got the idea of the thought, speech and action, and you've got the idea of effort. And that effort, that in each dimension there is effort. And so we're on line 12. That mitzvotai tishmuru vasitim otam, and the mitzvot, you should keep the mitzvot and do them, shahalimud mevi lidei maaseh, through the Torah study, which is with effort, one comes to action, hinei al yidei zeh, so it's through that. That means the thoughts, the speech, the action, studying Torah, doing mitzvot, with effort, tremendous effort, hinei al yedei zeh baim, through this we come l'chol habrachot ha'amurot behemshech ha'parsha, we come to all the blessings which are described in the continuation of this passage. V'natati gishmeichem be'itam, I will give your rain in its season, and so on. V'chol habrachot shel acharei zeh, all the blessings which are given after that, ad l'gu'ula b'ofen, till we come to a redemptive passage where it says v'hitalachdi b'tochachem, I will walk among you, v'olech etchem komemiyot, I will lead you, as the translator said, with your head held high. In fact, the Talmud describes it a little bit differently. The inyan komemiyot hu sheyubeko komat adam, it means we will stand high like Adam HaRishon. Adam HaRishon, Adam, the first man, was supposed to be very high. Supposed to be 100 cubits high. So we will stand high like Adam, whether it's meant physically or in some spiritual sense, or kishtei komot, or double as high as him, 200 cubits high. Kedi'ita b'mesechet Sanhedrin, as it says in Sanhedrin, page 100. It gives the reference here, note 5. So that idea of standing high in some spiritual sense, which, or physical sense for that matter, the Talmud means it literally. But what it means is the idea of some sort of redemptive empowerment and ennoblement, so that we feel high, we are high. That is really an aspect of the redemption. Ve'inyan ve'hitalachti, and when it says here ve'hitalachti, it doesn't say v'halachti, I will go. Ve'hitalachti in the reflexive verb, hu beit halichot, shtei halichot, it's two kinds of movement. Milamaila lamata, from above to below, and from below to above. Now, in other words, there are two aspects in our relationship with the divine. There's relationship with God as God pours down. It might be blessings, it might be Torah wisdom, it could be anything, but God is pouring it from above to below. And we are a receptacle for these blessings. We take the Torah, we try to learn the Torah. All of this is us accepting something that is given to us from above to below. But on the other hand, there's also milamata lamaila, there's from below to above. Below to above is the effort that we make. So God gives us various mitzvot that we should carry out. So in a sense, the command of the mitzvah is something coming from above to below. Look at this, how wonderful. God has given us this possibility to do this thing. And then we have to actually do it. Now that is from below to above. So doing it might mean all kinds of complicated practicalities. God gives us the concept of having a mezuzah on the door of our home. So first of all, in the Torah text, there's the text what the mezuzah should have in it. And then there's all the mitzvot, all the detailed rules about how the mezuzah should be written. then God gives us a home where we can put the mezuzah. Thank God. I mean, if someone lived in a ditch, they wouldn't have to fulfill the requirement of a mezuzah. They wouldn't have where to put the mezuzah. Even if they lived in a tent, most kinds of tents are not liable for a mezuzah. So God has given the person a house, a home, some kind of dwelling where they actually need a mezuzah. That's wonderful. So that's all coming from above. Then God supplies a sofer, a scribe, who somehow is available. One doesn't live in a place, there are people who live in places where the nearest scribe is 500 miles away. We live in a town surrounded by scribes. If you would put a little pin on the map, you know, where every scribe lives, it's not a huge number, but there's quite a number. So I see two scribes probably every morning. People who are scribes. Then, that's all from above. So God is providing all these different things. The text of the mezuzah, the actual mezuzah. He's given us the home where to put the mezuzah on the doorpost. And with the help of God, he's even given us the money to buy the mezuzah. Right, so now we got the mezuzah. But now we have to put it on the door. Now the big problem with mezuzah and doors is the usual technique for nailing, for putting the mezuzah on the door is nails. Where do you get nails? There are special shops that supply nails. I'm sure for David there's no problem getting nails. You know, craftsman.
B&Q.
Yes, you have to schlep all the way to B&Q. It's not like, it's not the little shop in the corner. You have to find a place where you get nails. Then, I mean, you can stick them to the door. Then you need the right kind of thing there as well. So then you're going to attach the mezuzah to the door. So if you have nails, you need a hammer. Right, you know, who's got the hammer? So all these, usually your wife. So there are various things from below to above which need to be put in place for the effort of keeping the mitzvah of mezuzah. So that's the movement from above to below and the movement from below to above. Which one is better? Hasidic thought always likes to discuss, you know, which is better? Is it better from above to below? That comes from higher, that's from God. But on the other hand, from below to above, that's our own efforts. There's something beautiful about that. And so then it says, "Hainu shela atid lavo," but in the future, in the time of the redemption, the time of Mashiach, "Yushter malot," will have both good points, both what is there of above to below, and also what's there from below to above. Ukumavo gam beinyan, as is explained also in the Talmud, where it speaks about v'samti kad kod shimsho sayich. I will make your windows. What does it mean, kad kod? So one explanation is kadein u kadein, like this and like that. That it means they will both be de la'atid lavo in the future. Yushter ma'alot avodah. Milamata lamaila u milamaila lamata. There'll be service both from below to above and from above to below, and they both of them will complement each other. So it'll be a very spiritual situation. So in other words, we have here a basic statement about serving God with our thought, with our speech, with our action, in a way of effort, and that eventually results in the beautiful blessings which are expressed in the Sedra. Those beautiful blessings are interpreted here, and to some extent in the Talmud as well, as blessings about the redemption, the future redemption. You see, you can understand what the Parsha is saying as being about going into the land of Israel, and it'll be very beautiful, and then if, God forbid, you do the wrong thing, then there'll be exile, which is which describes the history of the Jewish people. But the way these blessings are phrased is so intense and so beautiful that you can interpret them not about the living in the land of Israel before exile, but after exile. The redemption from exile then will be this tremendously beautiful experience, which includes this magnified spiritual stature, where the person is standing at this very high level and has both the virtue of from above to below and below to above, the service from below to above and above to below at the same time. All right, so that is the image. That's the image which is presented in the in this first page. Okay. Hi, how are you? You doing this? No, it's not. Okay. Right. Hatzlacha Rabba, which exams? Yeah. Right. Okay. So, now, here is where I see this on the second page as moving into the Lag Ba'Omer mode. What's Lag Ba'Omer? It doesn't talk about Lag Ba'Omer here, but this is how I understand it. Lag Ba'Omer, the main focus of Lag Ba'Omer is that it has to do with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai wrote the Zohar. And so a central concept is about Lag Ba'Omer is that it represents the Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah, of the inner dimension of the Torah, of the Zohar. We're coming towards Shavuot, which is the Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah, of the revealed Torah. What do we have at Shavuot? The Ten Commandments are very much revealed Torah, for the most part. They are talking about basic mitzvot, not to steal, not to murder. And these mitzvot are a part of the whole halachic dimension of the Torah. Then we have the oral Torah, which explains those mitzvot in all their details, which was also given to Moshe. True, the inner dimension of Torah was also given to him at the same time. But it's, or many aspects of it, or all of it. But that was hidden. What was the openly revealed Torah was the explanation of the practical mitzvah. So that is the Matan Torah of Shavuot. On the other hand, the Matan Torah of Lag Ba'Omer, that represents the Zohar, the mystical teachings in the Zohar, and the way they can become expressed through the generations in Hasidic thought, so that one is able to express those radiant teachings of the Zohar, the very name means radiant, Zohar, and express them in one's life. What is the purpose of these inner spiritual teachings? They make it quite clear, as it says in the Zohar, that Eliyahu HaNavi, who is the source of many of the teachings in the Zohar, says to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, "Bahai chibure dilach, with this book of yours, yifkun bnei Yisrael mingeluta, the Jewish people will go out of exile uberachmi, with mercy. Kad yefanusun minei, when they really imbibe, when they really drink in the teachings of the Zohar, that is when they will go out. That will help them go out of exile."
Why do you read?
I'm explaining. I'm not reading. Okay. I'm explaining as an introduction. So therefore, the Nekuda, the central point of Lag Ba'Omer, is Geula. It's redemption. Right, so that is the introduction to the next paragraph. Now, to understand the particular connection between the service that's been described above of thought, speech, and action of the mitzvot with effort, im ha-gu'ula, with the redemption. You see, so, I mean, the Rebbe might speak about the connection with the redemption at any time, but on the eve of Lag Ba'Omer, it's even more underlined. Hinei yedua, it's known. And now, just incidentally, with redemption, I just want to point out that in Hasidic thought, there are two kinds of redemption. There's the general redemption, where the whole Jewish people are redeemed. The temple is built in Jerusalem. All the former enemies of the Jewish people who didn't want the temple built in Jerusalem suddenly think that the best thing in the world would be to build a temple in Jerusalem. And all the nations who were very parav, or, you know, in some way opposed, suddenly become great friends and think, yes, we always said that's what the Jewish people should do. And claim, you know, rewrite history. So that's like political redemption, if you like. The redemption as a political reality, and no one goes to war anymore, and it becomes a very different kind of world, which is wonderful, and which we believe could take place at any moment. Terrifying. How it's going to happen exactly, we don't know, but it could be terrifying. You know, suddenly, the previous Rebbe wrote a description what the redemption will be like. He said a person will wake up in the morning, a person who has very, very little, you know, they're Jewish, but they don't have very much to do with Jewish life or teaching. Suddenly they feel, you know, maybe I should go to the Beit HaKnesset. Go to the synagogue. Now, it's an absurd thought. Why should you go to the synagogue? It's a Wednesday morning. You know, what is it that's pushing him to go to the synagogue? He goes to the synagogue. He finds the synagogue. Well, where's their synagogue? Oh, yeah. He finds the synagogue. The synagogue is packed with people. Everyone else had the same kind of feeling. They want to come. And he paints this picture of like this happening somehow, you know, in different places, and you know, this is all part of the transformation of the atmosphere at the time of redemption. All this is the external geula klalit, the general redemption, the redemption in terms of the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, the rebuilding of the temple, the cessation of all war, the cessation of all illness, miraculous aspects to the redemption. The Rambam puts it in a sort of rationally understandable way. He says in the time of the redemption, many new cures will be discovered. Grasses, herbs, which have got healing properties, will suddenly be found, which will heal this illness and that illness, and everyone who needs a refuah shleima should have now immediately a refuah shleima, and certainly will have in the time of Mashiach. You know, so that concept of refuah, of healing. So all that is the geula klalit, the general redemption. But from the very beginning, Hasidic thought taught about the geula pratit, the private redemption as well. That a person can live his or her life in such a way as if it is geula, and they can achieve some kind of inner spiritual redemption, which in many ways for them is like the type of redemption. I mean, when you put this to an extreme, in a certain sense, I never saw this in a Hasidic text, but I heard it in a lecture in the university, when a lecturer was trying to explain what is Hasidism. He was explaining this point, and he said, a Hasidic Rebbe lives in a redeemed state. He is in a state of geula pratit. He's in a state of personal redemption. What he then tries to do is help those around him either also achieve this personal redemption or achieve the general redemption. But the Hasidic Rebbe himself is in a state of personal redemption. The late Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote a very interesting comment, which you could interpret as a comment on this concept. He said that the person who themselves is experiencing private redemption, if they see that in the world somewhere, perhaps in a remote corner, there is one person who's not redeemed, then it means that their personal redemption is imperfect. Because if it was perfect, everyone would be redeemed. So, and in fact, you see we're now counting the Omer. Yes, so we have to count 49 steps, and then the 50th is Shavuot. So this idea of counting through 49 levels, now, it means that if one person is not redeemed, that means the person who is redeemed hasn't reached the 50th level. He's only on the 49th level. Now let's see, this word, Chet is 8, Vav is 6, Lamed is 30, Hey is 5. 30 and 6 and 8, that's 44, and 5 is 49. So the number 49 adds up to chole, which means ill. If you're only on the 49th level and not the 50th, you might feel that you're so spiritual. For you, it's as if the temple was never destroyed. You're living in an exalted spiritual space. But somewhere in the world, there's someone else who isn't. And that proves you're not on the 50th level, you're only on the 49th level at most. And that 49th level adds up to the word chole, ill.
So it means that anyone who has been redeemed has to look and help other people to be redeemed.
Yes. That's a very good definition of what being redeemed is. If the person who is redeemed doesn't look to help other people to be redeemed, he doesn't realize the limitation in his own redemption, and he becomes what is called, there's an old Yiddish havchana, a dichotomy between two types of tzaddik. There's the genuine tzaddik, and there's the tzaddik in pelts. The tzaddik with a fur coat. The idea is that it's very cold, and how do you become warm? So the tzaddik with a fur coat puts on a fur coat. He's warm, wonderful. He studies Torah, he prays with great sincerity and depth. He does mitzvah with tremendous feeling. But everyone else is cold. The other tzaddik, the more genuine kind of tzaddik, he lights a fire in the stove so that everyone becomes warm. That difference between the two kinds of tzaddik, so it extends over here. If you realize that your great spiritual attainments are in fact chole, are in fact ill, because somewhere in the world there is another human being, not necessarily Jewish, another human being who is unredeemed, who is unhappy, who is suffering, who is angry, so then it means that one's own redemption is not complete. One is still ill. See, it's an interesting question whether we regard normality as the way the world is now, and redemption as some beautiful, miraculous revelation, or do we regard redemption as normal, and what we are now as illness, as some problem? We're in a very negative situation. I heard, I don't know whether it's true, but I heard that Texas oil millionaires, in slang, when they're talking about when they found their millions, you know, because it would be by some chance usually that they discovered oil on their land, and suddenly this, $2 farmer turned into a millionaire. So they use the term, when I got cured. when I got cured, you know, getting cured was the moment of switchover from being a farmer struggling to make ends meet and suddenly turning into a millionaire with 10 Cadillacs. You know, so it's being cured, you know, so it fits with this Hasidic concept.
That's very interesting, because usually we think of redemption in context to Mashiach.
Well, it's talking about Mashiach.
But here it's not necessarily has to do with Mashiach.
If you talk about the private redemption, then it's what's called Mashiach Prati. You know, it's the private redemptive process.
What is Mashiach Prati?
Well, within each person, there is the Nekudah of the soul, which is called Yechida. And there's Nefesh, Ruach, Neshama, Chaya, Yechida. Those are five terms, and each one of them refers to a deeper and deeper level of the soul. So the level of Yechida, which is the innermost, most profound part of the soul, which is Yechida, meaning only one in the feminine, which joins together with Yachid, the only one in the masculine, which is God, that innermost dimension of the soul is the Nekuda of Mashiach, which is inside the person. So there is a dimension of Mashiach inside the person, and the private redemption is the revelation of that quality of Mashiach which is inside the person. So that's the sense in which this is Geula. It's general Geula, it's general Mashiach, and one can also understand it in terms of private Mashiach.
Something about what you said before, that on the communal redemption in the morning, people, one would get up and have a feeling he wants to go to the synagogue. This tchushat alev or tchusha mukdemet, is it real? I mean, how can it be explained?
Very simply, we're all connected together. All the neshamot, all the souls of the Jewish people are connected together.
Only the Jewish people?
Well, the Jewish people have this particular connection. They have a close relationship with everything else in the world as well. But there is a very intimate relationship between the neshamot of the Jewish people. So this is the network, if you like, of divine souls. The Nefesh Elokit, the divine soul. So if the divine soul as a whole wakes up, Kumi, Uri, yes, get up, wake up. If this divine soul dimension wakes up, so it wakes up in everyone. It can, you know, can wake up in everyone, and everyone is suddenly filled with this spiritual thirst, which they didn't have when they went to bed last night.
So, if we don't talk about redemption, if we talk about simpler things, sometimes people have kind of previous knowledge of the heart, maybe. It doesn't come from the head, about things that are going to happen.
Right. How does that work? Is that what you're saying?
Is it real, or is it can it be trusted, and first, and secondly, how does it work? Yes.
Well, look, it depends who, and it depends how. There's certain kinds of premonition which make a lot of sense. You know, the person has a premonition about something, and Paki, that's exactly what happened. Then there's then there are people who live their lives with a special kind of insight, with Ruach HaKodesh. A person like a Rebbe, or our Rebbe, you know, and some other Rebbein. They have a spiritual insight. And for them, you know, how is that to be used? How can that insight be used to the best way? It's, sometimes you have individuals who have, you know, without wanting it, as it said, have certain kinds of insight. I knew a woman who had a very, very spiritual perspective on life. And she had a very, very difficult life, and eventually she became very religious. She hadn't been brought up religious, but she became very religious. And that was the way that she resolved her the spiritual insight that she had. It led her to becoming an Orthodox Jewish woman, and carefully keeping mitzvot. That was, you know, the way she resolved the issues which were presented by this kind of
gift.
That's right. Which was almost a liability. It was problematic, and it hadn't helped her in life. She'd had an extremely difficult life. Very complex relationships with different people. And then, thank God, she was able to resolve it all, and in becoming a keeping its spot, and so bringing up her son in a very good way.
So actually you can look at it as a gift of God.
Yes, there are gifts. I mean, there are different levels of it, and I believe in people being connected. You know, what we call telepathy, things like that. I mean, you know, I've seen that in my relationship with certain people.
But it's frightening, you know, because if you have a premonition considering other people, and we are connected, this premonition can really affect what's happening. Because if the other person sensed this premonition, he would act to it. It's like going to a future teller. And you get your future as if, and then you fulfill it, you know?
You mean if you tell the other person?
Not tell.
Even if you don't tell?
No, telling, yeah.
See, there's an interesting thing about dreams. If a person has a problematic dream, then there is the idea that they have hatavat chalom, it's called. Improvement. Improvement of the dream. You go to a person and or three people, a bet din, and you say, I saw a dream, and the implication is it was a very problematic dream. You don't say what the dream was. You just say, I had a dream. And something, it's a nusach in the siddur, in the Chabad siddur, it's got it. And they say to you in Aramaic, Chelmatava chazit, you saw a good dream. Chelmatava chazit, you saw a good dream. Three times. There's a whole nusach what they say. So the fact they say it's a good dream, they are transforming it into something good, even though the dream seems something negative, but they're transforming it into something good. So,
so really, this kind of premonitions can really, well, if they're not good, can have an effect on the other person.
Well, so what one would advise, if it looks not good, that you make it good.
So I change my premonition?
Yes, somehow, yes.
Like you change the dream?
Well, that's the Yiddish phrase, tracht gut, wird sein gut. Think good, and it'll be good. And I don't know how exactly it's translated into Hebrew. Tachshov tov, yeh tov, something like that.
So it's in this case it's effective to change the premonition.
Yes.
And how can you change the premonition? I mean, it's something very deep. It's something. Well, I can work on it.
Yeah, I think
I'm changing it.
There is the idea that our thoughts affect reality. So if we feel we have a premonition, so we work on that premonition the other way.
It's frightening, you know?
It's exciting.
Isn't it?
No,
well,
exciting.
Yeah, we can think of it more positively.
Exciting, because you've got more control than you think.
But you're only human being, and you can dream badly too.
So then you improve.
Control your thoughts. You not always control yourself.
Not when you sleep, but afterwards.
No, even when you're awake, you don't control yourself.
Okay, what Hasidic thought wants us to try and do is control our thoughts. And to think good thoughts.
Well, you can make it a habit, but still there are slips, you know, you can slip out of it. It's a habit.
Then you slip down, then you jump up again. We're not perfect.
So our medium is supposed to work from premonitions.
Well, you see, once it becomes a kind of an organized thing, then you run into halachic problems.
Once, you know, like in the sort of East End type of jury type thing, it was sort of quite acceptable to sort of, they dallied a bit with sort of mediumship. It became fashionable, in a sense.
Well, I mean...
And just somebody in my family, they went there and was told that their daughter would die early before them, and she did. Of an illness. And I always wondered when I heard the story, because it's true, whether... by the fact that the medium said it caused it to happen, or whether...
Well, that's a good point. In my family, there was someone or other, unfortunately, kept having... they had girls. They gave birth to a girl, and unfortunately, she passed away. The baby died. They had another girl, the baby died. Had another girl, the baby died. It was terrible. They went to a Hasidic rabbi or a Gita Yid, it was told to me, like a good Jew, not exactly like a rabbi, but a person who could deal with this kind of thing. So he told her, and she'd just given birth to another little girl. He said, tell everyone that it's a boy, and make a Su'udat Brit. And at the Su'udah, at the banquet for the Brit Mila, for the circumcision, then you can announce that it's a girl. And after that, she'll be all right. And that's exactly what they did. They invited everyone. They got a moil, you know, like the whole thing ready. And then they bring the baby in, like very ceremoniously. And then they said, we'd just like to announce to you, this is not a boy, it's a girl. And she lived. I think she might be my grandmother, you know, my great-grandmother or something.
What's behind it? I mean, was it Aimra'a?
Well, it's he was making, maybe, I mean, he's making it Ein Tova. You're right. Maybe someone was jealous that they were having girls. And so by saying that it's a boy, normally people you might expect would be jealous the other way around. Yeah. But here it was.
So there is a basic to Ein Ra.
Well, we began off talking about the effect of good thoughts on people. So, Ein Ra, the idea that someone is envious of another person. So that's a bad thought. And
it can harm.
The Talmud takes it for granted that it's in like practical terms.
Really? And how can you defend yourself then?
Well, I think
the
important thing about defending oneself is not to be envious of another person.
No, that's not so much.
Don't worry about other people.
So, if you
in
are
that
not
sense, make sure that you don't. We make sure we're not going to be envious.
But there are lots of stories on bad things happening to people. The Rebbeim have said to go and ask, you know, can you think of an incident, and then go and ask.
Mechila.
Mechila.
Yeah.
Somebody.
So is there some way you've upset someone? Yeah, okay. Yeah, in that sense.
But the problem is that there are always going to be some people who are going to think badly of you, because, you know, that's the nature of human beings. You're not going to, you know, there's never going to be somebody who everybody thinks good of. There's always going to be, you know.
So maybe what one has to do is try to work on those people. You know, let's say you locate someone who thinks bad. About one, and just try to dissolve that away.
Dissolve?
Try to, you know, put it right in some way.
I think, yeah.
It sometimes happens, the following kind of scenario. A boy and a girl were engaged to get married. And then one of them broke off. Let's say the girl broke off the engagement. The girl subsequently marries another person. However, some time goes by, and everyone is expecting, when will she have a baby? And she wants to have a baby, and her husband wants it. Doesn't come. So they work out, you know, maybe with the advice of a rebbe or something like that. Make sure no one was upset about your marriage. So she remembers this person whom she was engaged to and whom she broke off the engagement. And she sends someone as a messenger to go and ask him, please be moichel, please forgive, she wants to apologize for any upset she caused you, please forgive her. I was actually involved in this once. I was the one going to ask the person to forgive the other person. He said, yes, I forgive him. Shortly after that, she got pregnant.
But you know, sometimes you are angry at someone, right? So you don't wish them bad. You don't wish them bad things, but you're angry, so you think bad things about them. So there's a difference between wishing something bad to happen to the other person and just being angry at someone and thinking how bad they are, how evil they are, and so on. But it's very good.
I think that's where we have to have Moach Shalat al Halev, the mind controlling the heart. I think that's very important. There has to be Moach Shalat al Halev. And in fact, just last night we were learning in another group, we were learning from Pirkei Avot, Ayin Hara V'Yetzer Hara V'Sinat HaBriyot
Briyot.
Motzi'im et ha'adam min ha'olam. The bad eye, the bad desire, and hatred of people takes a person out of the world.
Because what it does.
Yeah, it has an effect on them. It has a bad effect on them. Their bad eye about someone else, and their bad desires about someone else, and their hatred of someone else, actually has a destructive effect on themselves. Not to mention the bad effect.
Yeah, but we are human beings, and we...
Yeah, but being human beings means we can...
Every one of us is sometimes angry at someone, right? It might be the wife, it might be the husband, it might be, I don't know whom.
Yeah, but it says in the Talmud, Kol ha-ko'es ki'ilu oved avodah zara. Anyone who gets angry, it's as if they are serving idols. So if you have that as a fridge magnet on your fridge, it helps to control the anger, you know. Not 100%.
Yeah, but a psychologist in you should say, well, it's not. You keep all the anger inside instead of giving it.
That you know, in all my and my friend Rabbi Lou, you know, we have these shield groups with psychologists. This one area that we disagree. They say, yeah, you've got to express the anger.
Yeah, of course. Otherwise, you're going to explode.
Well, it depends how the anger is expressed, you know. It says in the Talmud that Abaya, I think it was, a famous rabbi, he would give his son what we would call seconds of earthenware bowls that hadn't been produced perfectly, and he could buy them cheaply. And he'd give them to his son would take a stick and smash these bowls as a way of expressing his anger. You know, what one does when one is 30 years old or 40 years old, you know, maybe one writes a poem. Or pure anger, I mean, one way of looking at anger is like it's like a drug. Person who loses their temper goes through a temporary ecstasy as if they were taking a drug. The only trouble is, like many drugs, it causes tremendous damage to people around them, and largely they're unconscious of the damage that it causes. Someone loses their temper with a child, doesn't you know, it can damage the child very seriously.
Fortunately, they're more resilient than we think.
They're more resilient. Well, I tell my pupils in school, if ever I lose my temper, you should know I'm only pretending.
Oh, yeah. I'll use that one next time.
So the result of that is I have very poor discipline in my class. Because if I ever do get angry, they just say, are you pretending? I say, yes.
One of my 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds are more perceptive than the 16-year-olds.
Well, it's an interesting thing.
How does all this fit with Pesach Sheni?
Well,
you asked it to go to Lag BaOmer, not to Pesach Sheni.
Yes, it's Lag BaOmer.
But it's Pesach Sheni tomorrow.
I know, but this discourse doesn't speak specifically
what
about
Pesach Sheni.
Pesach Sheni is the idea that it's in the Torah that God told the Jewish people to celebrate Pesach. This was in the second year of going out of Egypt. And some people came and said, we wanted to celebrate Pesach, but we were impure. So what can we do? They were impure because they'd been involved carrying a coffin with Yosef, so they're impure. So
they were doing a mitzvah.
Yeah, they were doing a mitzvah. Nonetheless, it made them impure, so they couldn't keep Pesach. They couldn't bring the offering of the Pesach offering. So, as a result, there was a new mitzvah added that a month, if you couldn't keep the first Pesach, a month later you keep the second. So tonight is the 14th of Iyar, which is a month after the 14th of Nisan.
So tonight is
Leila Seder. So that's right. So there's a custom to eat matzah tomorrow, tonight and tomorrow, to eat matzah.
Everybody?
Yeah. Yeah, you have bread as well, but to have some matzah symbolizing...
matzah sandwich, you know.
Yeah.
Open your pizza, thump in the matzah.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Expressing the idea of Pesach Sheni.
We haven't got any matzah.
Okay, so if we come back briefly to the discourse, it's already late. The way this discourse moves is the idea that ultimately the purpose of existence is the redemption. That is the purpose of... So the purpose of existence is not chole or choli, but health. That's the goal. And it was created for that purpose right at the beginning. Let's look from line 15 on page Zayin. That means the second paragraph. Ubeyo in Yanhu. The explanation is dehine yadua, it's known masha amru rabbeinu, that which our sages said nitava kadosh baruch hu liot lo yitbarach dira betachtonim, that God desired to have a dwelling in the lower world. The lower world means the world that we're in, which apparently conceals God, but the ideal, the desire, the goal in this creation is that God should dwell there. In other words, the world which conceals God should be the dwelling for God and should reveal God. V'zeo tachlit kavanat ha-briyah. That's the ultimate purpose of creation. La'asot lo yitbarach dira betachtonim, that God should have a dwelling in the lower world. V'hainu, that means the mitzad lemaila, as far as God is concerned above, kva yeshna kavanazu, this intention is there, bebriyat ha'olam, in the creation of the world, dechatchila, from the very beginning. That's the whole purpose. Eilu shebnei Yisrael al yedei avodatam, but we, the Jewish people, through our service, tzrichim lahamshich ta'avazu, we have to draw this desire. Interesting phrase, lamshich, minatava, from a desire, elakoach, to something which is tangible but only potential, uminakoach elapoel, and from something potential to something actual, like the tava of food. The way in which people eat, like a nicely prepared meal, first of all, there's an hors d'oeuvre. What's the point of the hors d'oeuvre? It's to make the person feel the ta'ava to eat. And then you begin giving them food, gradually moving mehakala la kaved, till finally they're eating the main course. You know, but it's like a gradual process. If you give them the main course straight away at the beginning, they might feel, oh, I'm not in the mood. But you go, you move step by step, gradually, and in that way you are mamshich et ha-tava. You draw out the desire, and then it becomes from a potential desire to an actual desire. Now, in terms of this relationship with God that we're speaking about, ve'al yedei ze na'aseh adam shutaf la'kadosh baruch hu b'ma'aseh bereishit, the person becomes a partner with God in the work of creation. Al yedei avodato la'asot et hadira b'poel, through his or her effort to make this dwelling, in practical terms. The inyan ze ye la'atid lavo, that will be in the future, bigmar shleimut avoda, with the completion of the service, what we have to achieve. V'yesh lomar, one can suggest, the fact that this intention is from the very beginning part of creation, this itself is the power that the Jewish people have to achieve it. It's there. It's part of creation, and they're able to do it. So in other words, the concept of Mashiach is implanted in creation at the very, very beginning. In other words, Mashiach is not something which comes as some extra mystical dimension to existence. Mashiach is built into existence. The need for Mashiach and the reality of Mashiach is really what the whole world was created about. See, another way of describing this is about what happened, the whole concept of Gan Eden, the whole concept of the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden gives an image of what the world is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a very beautiful world, and in that world you have Adam and Chava, man and woman, and together with them is the presence of the divine. And that's how things are supposed to be. The only thing is, things went wrong, they disobeyed, they did something wrong, and so they were driven out of the garden, and the divine was concealed. So we then have the world as we have it today. But it's supposed to be the Garden of Eden. So, and the Garden of Eden becomes the goal, what we have to achieve, but not just in the garden, in the whole world, and everyone. And the crucial point will be the presence of the divine. Now here it brings another image about the way in which Mashiach is built into creation. What the sages said, ala pasuk, v'ruach elakim rachefet al pnei ha-mayim. The verse says, the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the water. This is line 5 on page 8. And the sages said, zuru choshel Mashiach. This means, the Spirit of Mashiach, the Ruach Elohim, actually means the Spirit of Mashiach. That means before the creation in detail, at this point there was just water. There was already the idea of the Spirit of Mashiach. Hainu, that means hakavanava hatachlit, the goal, the purpose, shetit galel la'atid lavo, which will be revealed in the future. And you see, we can have this, there are many different images about this idea. You know, when someone builds a building, they have in mind what the building is going to be, and the whole goal of what the building is. And they have that focus. That's why they build the building in this particular way. The building is going to have a theater, and it's going to have science laboratories. You know, like they think, what is it going to have? And so with that basis, they plan the architecture of the building. So in the same way, God plans what's going to be in the world. What is the world? The world is to be a revelation of the presence of the divine. So that's the whole Kavanat HaBriyah. That's the purpose of creation. And then comes the step-by-step, stage-by-stage process of creation. So this is basically the thrust of this discourse, that everything in the world is actually there waiting. The whole world was created in such a way that we should fulfill this process of transforming the world into Olamo Shel Mashiach, the world of Mashiach, the world of Geula. And that gives a tremendous confidence, I think, to the way that a person looks at life. There are many challenges in life. But if a person sees that really that challenge is only there, that was part of the Kavanah of the Briah, of the creation, that we should overcome that challenge or deal with that challenge in one way or the other, and through that we will achieve our own step in the process of Geula. And the Geula, that quality of Geula is waiting for us. That's really what we have to achieve. That quality of Geula is waiting for us, just waiting to be revealed. And the step that we make reveals it. And so whatever the problem that is facing us, that's what we have to achieve. So then it speaks, it comes back to the concept of amelim, of efforts. The idea that this is through efforts. And that's on page 10. Is a whole exposition about this concept of effort, because the way is, whether it's in thought or in speech or in action or in Torah study or in doing mitzvot, there's always the dimension of effort, and it's that effort which is the power which transforms and brings about the redemptive quality in existence. And that's what it means if we go to the very last page, where it sort of wraps up again with the concept of Im b'chukotai telechu, if you walk in my statutes. That means the avodah with the three garments of thought, speech, and action, that this is the upholding of Torah, the mitzvot, and also this is the idea of the effort that we make. And that is the concept of the letters which are engraved in the soul. The letters engraved in the soul. And through, that's line 7. Ha'otiyot, zeh b'chinat otiyot ha'chakikah shebenefesh, the letters engraved in the soul. Al yedei zeh baim l'chol ha'brachot, through that one comes to all the blessings. Hamniyot behemshech ha'pasha, which are listed in this passage in the Torah. As we learn, ukadita bazoah, as it says in the Zohar, that the kutshu b'richu istakil b'oraita uvara alma, God looked in the Torah and created the world. Barnash mistakil b'oraita mekayim alma, we look in the Torah and we keep the world in existence. V'ad shebaim l'chol ha'yehudim shel acharei zeh, till we come to all the good things which are in the future. V'yishavtem levetach ba'atzechem, you will dwell, and which is the next verses in the parsha, you will sit securely in your land. V'natati shalom ba'aretz, I'll give you peace in the land. Ad v'olech etchem koma miyut, I will make you walk upright. U'bifchat al pi avtachat v'divrei, the previous Rebbe, especially according to the promise and words of the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, she'anu omdim kvar bizman de'ikvata de'mashicha, we are on the heels of the heels of the Mashiach. V'yikuyim miyad mashe katuv, and it should be achieved immediately what's written, v'hitalachti b'tochachim, God will walk among us. V'ayiti lachem lelekim, and God will be for us as God. B'mheira b'yameinu mamash, swiftly in our days, Beviat Mashiach Tzidkenu, with the coming of the righteous Mashiach.
Amen. May I ask
something? Yeah, sure.
I have many questions. Chabad looks at the last Rebbe of Lubavitch as a Mashiach, right?
Well, he's triggering off Mashiach.
Triggering. So is it a kind of a private redemption of him, revealing his inner Mashiach?
That's certainly so. I mean, every Hasidic Rebbe is really that. Every Hasidic Rebbe represents a quality of private redemption that he is sharing with his followers. What the Rebbe was trying to do was to bring the general Mashiach. And his teachings are, in a sense, tefillot. They are prayers to bring about the Mashiach. And also, he believed, as we see in the Zohar, that Torah can change the world. So there's a story about Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, that once there was a drought, the world needed rain. And Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai said a Torah on the words, Hinei matovu u'man na'im shevet achim gam yachad, how beautiful it is when brothers sit together. And when he came to the end of this Torah teaching, the rain began falling. So in other words, Torah teaching can change reality. So the Rebbe believed that by teaching Torah about Mashiach, it will actually bring Mashiach in a tangible way. And so I believe that the teachings of the Rebbe will help to bring Mashiach.
And the idea that there were seven rabbis and the Chabad didn't elect a new rabbi, does it have to do with Mashiach?
Well, it does in a sense, because the seventh rabbi, you see, Moshe was the seventh from Abraham. Okay. There's Abraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov, Levi, Kahat, Amram, Moshe. That's the seven generations. So Moshe is the seventh generation from Abraham. So the idea is that Kol HaShvim Chavivim, that all the sevenths are precious. And so being the seventh, Moshe was able to bring the divine presence back into the world fully. Abraham began it and Moshe completed that. So, which is putting right what happened in the Garden of Eden, first eating from the tree and then Cain killed Hevel, and then one thing after another, there were seven negative things there as well. So Abraham begins the process of bringing back the Shekhinah into the world, and the seven generations continue that, and Moshe is the seventh and he fulfills it. He gets Matan Torah and the building of the Mishkan and the divine presence in the Kodesh Kodoshim, in the Holy of Holies of the sanctuary. So the Rebbe is the seventh after Rabbi Shneur Zalman. So the general way of understanding the Rebbe and the way the Rebbe thought about his generation as well is that the seventh generation has that spiritual power. If you like, especially, he became Rebbe in 1951, immediately after the Holocaust. So he saw this as a crucial point in Jewish history. And but on the simplest level, the teachings of the Rebbe bring a private redemption, and that private redemption is a step towards the general redemption.
By the definition you had earlier of Cholevi 49, none of the Rebbeim or anybody else has been perfect, because there are people who are not right still.
Right. I mean, this is what the Rebbe said. If one person would achieve the full extent of what can be achieved, then the whole world would be transformed.
About manipulation again. If it's so that if I think something about someone else, I have a power to change him or to. That's really even if I think a good thing, you know, I think this person needs something X. This is good for him. who am I to decide what's good for him, right? So in a way, I manipulate his future. Just by thinking. It's dangerous.
Yeah, I would put it.
It really works. So.
Yeah, but I would put it in more general terms. You know, you want the good of the other person. I mean, what is it? The way to hell is paved with good thoughts.
I mean, really, people can do a lot of damage by believing that they know what's good for the other person. It's really dangerous.
Well, that's a different aspect to it. A person thinking that they know what is good for another person.
Want
good for another person is different to saying he should do that or this.
I'm just thinking this person needs to do X, Y, Z, you know. I know what's good for him. And I think about
this
it.
Sounds
and it
like
can affect his future. That's dangerous in a way.
I don't know whether it always will affect his future. You know, if the thought is with bon foi, with good faith, you know, maybe it's, or maybe not. Listen, the point is that thought has an effect. Whether it always has an effect or whether it sometimes has an effect is if we live our lives carefully, because we're aware that thought has an effect, then I think we will be happier. It means that the person will not allow negative thoughts about other people to play through their minds if they feel more sensitive to them. That's how I see it. You know, each teaching can be taken to extremes, whatever the teaching is, which can become problematic. And one has to be able to take every teaching in a balanced way that is positive for oneself and for others and for the totality of existence, you know, in terms of what the Torah wants of us.
Yeah. Because if you say things to the other person, he can protect himself and says, no, I don't agree with you, this is not good for me, so on. But if you think these things, the other person cannot protect themselves. You see? So it has more power than speaking directly.
Well, I mean, the point is, Ruth, you described before that you actually lived through this, as you described with your son. You know, so sometimes if people see that their thoughts have that kind of effect, you know, it's right that they should work on themselves.
It wasn't a thought, it was a feeling. I send him love. I think I cannot do harm with sending love to anyone.
Absolutely.
Okay? Yeah. That's harmless. But if I think, I'm taking another example. If I think my son should do this and this and this, and I just think about it and try to influence him, manipulate
him. I don't know whether that worked. I don't know whether that
hopefully
works.
Not
you know, just because you know this would multiply the Jewish mother complex.
I have good intentions, you know.
this would magnify the power of the Jewish mother, which is not necessarily mine.
I wonder if government didn't start using this as a power, because if it works, it's really a power, you know, you can control other people.
Well, maybe that's how communism fell.
That's why
everyone felt so bad about it that it collapsed.
Well, some people we knew did an experiment in Australia, and they decided that there was communication, i.e. there's very strong verbal, and every morning they bought a farm, and they went out every morning and called to the birds and said, please leave our crops alone, please. I have to say, the farm was a complete disaster, and they had to leave it. But the whole process was, they didn't want to interfere, and they wanted to talk to the birds on the same level as them, and they spoke to them every morning, and it was quite incredible. Just that
the farm a disaster because the birds ate the crops, or for other reasons?
No, but I was just taking it as a funny step along the way.
I read 100 years ago or more, someone did an experiment where they talked to plants.
Yeah. Well, that's
and they claimed that the plants that they spoke to nicely grew better than the other plants.
Yeah. smile.
Yep. Okay.